Welcome to ApplauseCast Travel.
What I'd like to do is to just read a brief section of the introduction to my latest I won't call it a travel book, it's a kind of exploration book. It's called Seasons on Harris, and it's an introduction, a rather odd way of introducing the island, but it's actually true. That dream came again, as it has done now on many occasions since my first visit to Harris a number of years ago. It's one of those floating, flying dreams I'm told possess significant, if ambiguous, interpretations, assuming, of course, that you believe in such things, which I usually don't much. It goes something like this. I'm way up in the northern highlands of Scotland, releasing myself like a bird from the jagged, storm-gashed fangs of the Coolin Mountains on the astoundingly beautiful, legend-rich island of Skye. I'm floating dreamily among high cirrus feathers toward the Outer Hebrides, that wild and fragmented 130-mile-long string of islands, 30 or so westward miles from the mainland, way out in the Atlantic. Below me, far, far below, I can see the lines of whitecaps frothing across a treacherous current-laced channel known as the Minch. Here, so folk tales tell, is the haunt of the dreaded blue men who plague unfortunate sailors in storm-racked gales, often sweeping them down to deep, dark depths where they, when they fail to answer complex riddles and rhymes, while frantically trying to keep their frail crafts afloat. Mainlanders and incomers often smirk at such tales. The island fishermen do not. And then slowly, through a blue sea haze, an island emerges, a looming surge of mountains to the north, broken black granite summits, and the oldest known rocks on earth, once Everest size, so they say, but now worn to somnolent stumps, wrapped in cloud tatters, aloof and proud. This is the island of Harris. And with just the slightest bird-like tilt, I ease my floating body down and sweep lower over the small harbor town nestled cozily in a rocky cleft. The barren, treeless moors sweep back inland, great swaths of olive green, bronze, and gold marsh grass tussocks, and deep purple carpets of heather pocked with tiny acidic peat water lakes or lochans frilled by explosions of gorse and broom. And then suddenly, in a masterwork of topographical trickery, appear mile after mile of slow-arcing, blonde-gold beaches sparkling against a Caribbean turquoise ocean, with slappy wavelets easing up talcum-soft sands. Surely this is the last thing one expects to see in such a surly, burly landscape, and yet here they lie, arc after golden arc, framed by bosky green sheen dunes stretching southwards as I fly down closer to the ocean, skimming the wings of herring gulls and golden eagles, seeing my reflection flash and ripple in the slow tides. And then comes a long, slow curl above scattered crofting homes and the weedy humps of far older dwellings with skeletal bones of stone walls 3 or more feet thick, the bold remnants of island blackhouses, along with Bronze Age burial sites and solitary standing stones whose origins are as mysterious and mythical as the place itself. The boulder-strewn spine of the island emerges again as I curl around its southern shore, but this time even more pugnacious and lunar in its lonely isolation. No more glorious beaches here, just tight, rock-bound bays and tiny huddled homes set in clefts and cracks of shattered granite. At first, all is silence. Then comes a sound, a distant clicking, clacking sound, as I float lower, and it becomes a patterned clickety-clack, 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 and I swoop in a shallow loop to the sound of the source. in a small tin lean-to shack at the end of a croft home, and gently my feet touched the soft grass by the shack, and I strolled slowly to the rain-stained window and peer inside. And there at a rust-crusted cast-iron loom sits an elderly man, perched on an angled wooden bench, his feet rhythmically pedaling the old noisy contraption. One hand guides the weaving shuttle across the hundreds of tight warp threads, the other strokes and caresses the finely patterned cloth, slowly emerging on the spool weft by tight weft. And I see his hands, rock rough and thickly veined, gene-linked to generations of crofter weavers, those weavers of the Clomore, the great cloth, for which this strange little island is known across the whole wide world. This tweed, this tough, instantly recognizable tweed of Harris, the cloth of kings, is familiar to all of us for its peat reek and its tickle and its enduring character. And the man's huge hand strokes the cloth with the familiarity of an old friend, and his rheumy eyes twinkle, and he is proud, and I am here now with him as the sound of the loom ceases. He sighs a long sigh, and I watch his hand slowly pulling a worn oilcloth over the unfinished woven tweed, tight on its spool. The old man stands a little unsteadily, reaches out to a small lopsided table near the loom, and picks up the local newspaper with a prominently dramatic headline that reads, "The End of an Island is Harris Tweed Doomed."
This is Larry Habiger with Traveler's Tales, and we're here today with Steve Morrow from ApplauseCast and David Yeadon, author of Seasons on Harris and many other books. David is in Mohegan Lake up the Hudson Valley in New York.
Very good.
That's great stuff.
It's really great to hear you read it, David. It's just wonderful to hear this stuff read aloud in your mellifluous voice.
Every time I Larry and I interview an author, and the author is kind enough to do a reading for us, one of the things that is reinforced in me is why kids love to be read to. As an adult, you don't get read to very often anymore, or if you get read to, it's usually the Riot Act, right?
one of the nicest little bonuses when I travel, and I'm lucky enough to persuade Anne, my wife, to come with me, which is actually about 60-70% of the time, she loves reading aloud. And I love driving. So I do most of the driving on condition that she reads to me as we drive. And it's a wonderful combination. I mean, you fall in love with the sound and the rhythm of words. And I think with a lot of modern writing, we've got so enamored with this Hemingway sparseness and as if the only thing we should aim for in writing is cold and rather stoic-like simplicity. I don't write that way, as you can possibly.
Well, David, I think you're right. You know, there is something of a loss of eloquence in modern writing.
Yes.
And
yes.
You know, it's to have the ability to write so fluidly in somewhat convoluted sentences and deep imagery is it's a real talent. It's a real gift. And,
well, I'll be really honest. I'm not particularly good at the computer, and I never was a very good typist. So I found this wonderful assistant who works with me, and I actually read all my chapters onto cassette tapes, and then she transcribes them, and then I start the laborious process of editing that can go on forever and ever. But I mean, that at least allows me to hear the rhythms, to hear the music of the words, to hear the alliterations and take them out wherever I can, just to enjoy the whole feast of all the different aesthetics that go along with words. It's not just speed reading, a horrible idea, and it's not just simplicity, which I never understood this love for utter simplicity. Not that I think anybody should write like Henry James anymore with, paragraphs that go on for two whole pages, But certainly, if only they'd write a bit more like Dylan Thomas or Brendan Behan or somebody like that, and rejoice in words, just rejoice in the sheer extravaganza and the richness of images that you get with words. And I think that's what kids love. They can close their eyes and they can vanish into this wonderful world of words.
I think the other part of it is that, we're huge fans of technology. We use it all the time. But technology compresses time, and so the way we communicate via technology is in little short bursts of incomplete sentences that you sort of interpolate to mean such and such.
I got a call yesterday from a friend of mine who's the city architect of a large city in England, actually a very impressive city, and he has some teenage children. And he was going, and he also shares my love of words and rhythms and all that kind of thing. And he was going bonkers over some of the text messages that these kids trade backwards and forwards on their cell phones. And I think, he just feels as though he's being left out completely. But he does worry about what's happening to the English language when it's whittled down to an amazingly incomprehensible shorthand, at least to most of us.
Well, it's interesting because that is going in a strange direction, and I think that's where the educational systems need to continue to encourage study of proper use of language and as you said, David, the rejoicing in what words can do. I want to go back a second to what you were saying about the way you actually craft your work and the way you produce it. Did I hear right that you write in longhand? Is that the way you write initially?
I write in longhand on not yellow pads, but certainly nice white rule pads with these amazing little Pilot pens, Pilot Precise they're called, extra fine. And yeah, I mean, I can laboriously type, but for some reason, the hand and mind connection doesn't work anything like as well as it does by using a pen and paper. Having admitted all this, I'm now beginning to feel a bit embarrassed, but it seemed such a natural process for years, and I've been doing this for almost 30 years now, that I've never really questioned it. And thank God I've just got this wonderful friend who loves transcribing and also happens to rather enjoy my books. And so, it's a way that I can edit by listening to a book. And I don't think many writers do that. I don't think many writers read aloud their own writing, even when they're in the editing process. I think it's an alien thing. Hopefully, as we get more and more into audiobooks, which seem to be having a second life now, then maybe writers will listen to the words a little bit more closely.
I do a lot of teaching of writing, and one thing I talk about, and this gets talked about a lot in the various courses that I teach and that I see other people teaching, is the best way to edit is to read your stuff aloud or
yes.
to have someone
oh,
read it
great.
To you, one way or the other. And
congratulations. I bet you're one of the few people that actually teaches that in the country.
I don't think so. It may be that not that many people actually do it, but I think people who know writing and know editing know that the best way to get a sense of whether the words are working is to hear them read aloud. And ideally, you read them yourself, and then you realize, oh, this is kind of cumbersome, or this really stumbles, knocks me down, that sort of thing. And you get a sense of what's working and what's not.
Absolutely. In fact, we were listening. It's funny. We had a drive last week up to Vermont. We'd lost a friend of ours, and we had to go to Memorial, and Anne said, why don't you get a couple of audiobooks? My voice is a bit shot, she says, so get a couple of audiobooks from the library. And one of them I got was a Stephen King thing, and I only got it because unusual for Stephen King, it happened to be only two tapes long, which was just about the time it would take to get to Vermont. And it was, for Stephen King, it was actually quite enjoyable. It was a series of novellas, four novellas. But I realized that it wasn't read by Stephen King, and he'd never read it aloud to himself because he did what a lot of writers tend to do if they don't read aloud, is that they repeat words very in close proximity. And to me, there's nothing more annoying to hear some word like center or whatever it most or whatever it may be, beautiful, occurring three times in one paragraph. And that kind of editing is so simple to do. In fact, most publishing houses should be able to do that. But the problem nowadays is that most publishing houses don't have editors in the traditional sense. They have copy editors. But most editors now are like book producers, and they have to worry more about sales and bottom lines than they do about helping the author craft the best thing he can possibly craft.
That's kind of the way publishing has gone, and it's unfortunate, but yeah. You know, it's a new time, and you know, there are a lot of pressures on publishers and the book world in general.
Oh yeah.
But I want to ask you a question or two, David, about The Seasons on Harris, your new book.
Yeah.
The subtitle is A Year in Scotland's Outer Hebrides. It's the island famous for Harris Tweed, and I'm just wondering, how did this book come about, and how did you choose Harris?
Well, I'm going to blame Anne again. Fortunately, she's not with me, so I can blame her for all kinds of things. And she'll possibly never hear this, so that's even more. I'd done a lot of world travel books for National Geographic and also for HarperCollins and a number of other companies. And with titles like, Hidden Corners of This, Back Roads of That, Lost Worlds, The Back of Beyond, all wonderful sort of exploratory travel tales going into areas that were not, in fact, rarely, if ever, tourist areas and not particularly well known to even the more adventurous travelers. And that I loved because I felt it was a constant sense of exploration. But it meant that, for example, a book like Lost Worlds had 20 chapters in it all over the world, Tasmania, China, Bangkok, down in the islands of the Gulf of Thailand, all over India, up in Nepal. So the chapters were relatively short, they're only like 5,000 or 6,000 words. And I was happy with that. It was kind of National Geographic length, and I was doing a lot of stuff for Geographic. But Anne sort of said, listen, why can't we just go to one of these places and give ourselves 100,000 words just to describe one place, and we can really get to know the people, really get to know the culture. Not that you're being superficial, she says, but at the same time, you're not really pursuing any of these little carrots that you keep dangling on sticks. You're always hopping off to the next place. So we gave it a shot, and the first book we brought out was absolutely fascinating, called Seasons in Basilicata, which is a very wild and remote and little-known region of southern Italy, little-known even to the Italians.
David, let me just one quick thing. My family is from that region of Italy.
You're kidding.
And no, from Potenza.
Oh my God! Yeah,
I went with my grandmother who came to this country when she was two.
Right.
On one of her first trips back to Italy, and we went and visited her village, and it's pretty much the way you describe it.
Do you remember the name of the village?
Yeah, Forenza.
Oh my! Yep, absolutely. Well, I was down. We were down for a big. In fact, for almost the whole time. Our base was Aliano, which is only about an hour's drive south from where you're talking about. The last 20 minutes of that hour is spent climbing up a vertical hillside with hairpin bends to actually get to the village. But that's where Carlo Levi, who wrote that wonderful book, Christ Stopped at Eboli, was imprisoned by Mussolini. And he was considering suicide and then decided to write a book about the people of Aliano. And my book was a kind of homage to him, and also to see how things had changed, or in fact not changed, since he was there in the 40s. And I think that's what made the book so enthralling, that all the black magic and all the witchcraft and all the paganism and all the other strange superstitions that just wrecked this village was still well and truly in place.
Let me just say, I never knew exactly what was going on the whole week we were there with my grandmother, because there were certain words I understood, like strega, which means witch.
Yeah.
And there was always these strange conversations that I would hear words that I would know that I would ask my grandmother about, like, is somebody a witch here in the village? You know, these are the kinds of things I'd like to know.
Yep.
And she wouldn't talk to me about it.
No, it took us about 6 months before people would tell us more about the three witches in Aliano. Two of them were rather ill, so they weren't functioning too well, but the other one was a real cracker, a demon cracker. That was the closest translation I could get. You didn't cross this woman, and unless you had a good reason to go and knock on a door, you just didn't go. It wasn't a matter of, like everybody else we interviewed there, we just go and hammer on the door, and we usually get invited in for dinner, you know, and or certainly a healthy round of drinks. But I was told, in fact, we never got to meet her. We saw her a number of times, but we never were able to pin her down, literally. And I think we actually began to buy into this thing, that she really did have powers that you didn't mess around with. A lot of our traditions revolved around olive trees, because that was one of the key things at the poor, and they, when I say poor villages, they were incredibly poor. Amazingly happy, but very poor. And everything was all kinds of mystique to do with olives and when you should harvest and making sure, how do you make sure you get your olive oil from the press? How do you know it's not somebody else's garbage oil? And how you cast a spell on a tree and actually stop the tree from growing olives. All, there must have been about 20 superstitions and actual things you could do with and to olive trees. I should have done a whole book on olive trees.
Did someone show you how to keep away the evil eye?
With the
hand position and the fingers.
Yes.
Okay.
And one is a very elaborate one too. There's one if you actually feel as though it's something has got inside you. That's a little bit more elaborate. But the other one is basically a very protective technique, as if somebody was about to hit you.
Yeah. Let's go back to Harris. How did you get to Harris?
Sorry about
via
that.
Basilicata, obviously.
That was the first book. And then we looked, you know, we were talking with my editor, and he says, well, where do you want to go next? Do you want to do another one of these, or do you want to go back to the world travel thing? And I talked, and we said, no, you know, we enjoyed Basilicata so much, and just getting into the depth of all the folklore and really getting to know people, let's go somewhere else. And Harris came up very quickly. We actually had gone there 20 years ago, and I did a piece for a magazine mainly about the Crofter weavers, because the thing about Harris Tweed is that it has to be made by a crofter in his own home, the actual weaving. The warp is supplied by the mill, on a spool, but the actual weaving with the weft of the cloth has to be done in the home. And that's what makes it so distinct from almost every other tweed in the world, and a little bit more expensive, too.
When you say it has to be done in the home, that is by law or proclamation?
Yeah,
it's
an actual official act of parliament. You know,
okay.
It's got a number, and it's got a royal seal to it, and it's got the whole kit and caboodle. And they'll drag it out. If you ever question it, they'll drag it out at the Harris Tweed Association. It defines exactly where the wool can come from, and it only relates to the Outer Hebrides. If you've got weavers doing tweed back in the Highlands of Scotland, that doesn't count. That can't be called Harris tweed. Ironically, only a small amount, a relatively small amount of tweed is actually made on Harris, because the whole population of Harris is less than 2,000 people. Most of the weavers are actually on Lewis, which is the sister island of Harris, a much larger, much bleaker, much wilder island in some ways, but nothing like as beautiful as Harris. Anyway,
and is that also called Harris tweed?
You could even way down at the bottom of the Outer Hebrides, as I read, is about 125, 130 miles long, and there's a whole string of islands. Start with Lewis, and then Harris, and then the Usts, and then we end right at the bottom in an absolute charmer of a place, again with a very small population, about 2,000 people, called Barra, B-A-R-R-A. And even if you weave tweed down there, it's still called Harris tweed. So long as it comes from the Outer Hebrides, it's labeled Harris tweed. But
okay.
if it comes from the Highlands of Scotland or any other island, it's not included. But anyhow, so we managed to convince our poor editor that this was a candidate for book number two in the series, and so now it's become a series, which wasn't the intention. We were going to do one of these and then go. I was going to go back to gallivanting around the world again, but Anne sort of said, you know, let's do Harris. Now we're into a third book, which which is in the southwest corner of Ireland, the Beara Peninsula, which is just south of the Dingle Peninsula in the Ring of Kerry. And I won't tell you too much about that, except we're having a ball down there. And of course, as opposed to the Harris people, who are mainly Presbyterian and very Calvinist, and nothing happens on a Sunday, and they are very, very religious, what we have in southwestern Ireland are Catholics, and God, do they know how to live? I mean,
that's right.
They live a fine kind of life down there.
So, David, when can we look forward to seasons in Beara or whatever it's going to be called?
That'll be finished early spring in terms of the draft text, and that means all being well. If Harper, it still takes so long to get a book out. This is what amazes me in this time of fast everything. It still takes up to nine months to get a book out, so it should be out towards the end of the year of 2007. And of course,
okay.
I make it more complicated because I do all my own illustrations, and that takes time to get that designed properly. And then we have the battle over whether we use brown ink on cream paper for the text or black ink on white paper. And so far, I've won twice. We get dark brown ink on cream paper.
And I know that you were a strong proponent of that a few years ago when we were talking about some things, and
now I'm revealing how truly old-fashioned I am, but I remember when I was a kid and I got a book for Christmas or my birthday or whatever, and my father tells me the first thing I used to do was to crack the book open and stick my nose right down deep into the fold of the book itself, where you could smell the paper and you could smell the ink. And different types of books and different series of books would have entirely different smells. I don't know why, except they use different paper and different ink. But everything, at that point, I realized that a book was not just a lot of words on a page. It was a total aesthetic unit. It had many, many levels of aesthetics. And I've always treated my books that way. I design them myself, and fortunately HarperCollins are very good and tend to go along with it. And I do all the sketches, like I said, and I do all my own maps. And to me, the whole thing is one unit. The writing, the sound of the words, the look of the words, the color of the ink, the sketches, the design, the size of the font, the shape of the book, the cover. I mean, it's all one thing of beauty. And I don't think a lot of writers actually see it that way, which is perfectly understandable because they're primarily just doing text. But to me, it's much more than text.
David, you obviously enjoy the process of creating a book.
Absolutely.
It almost sounds like you're describing like a master chef putting together a dinner.
Well, I love cooking as well.
Let me tell you, Steve, David's meals are very, very good.
We should film you making the dinner then. We should do it. Making a dinner, and then Larry and I will consume it, of course.
You would be more than welcome. But, that brings up a point that Larry and I had loads of discussion about when I did a book with Larry and James called The Way of the Wanderer for Traveler's Tales. And it was a wonderful opportunity that I was given that nobody else had given me. Literally, they said, they asked the big question that I don't think any of the radio TV interviewers had ever really asked, which was why? You know, why are you doing all this? Why are you, you had a very good job as an urban designer, a master planner, city planner, and on the hot track towards partnerships and all that stuff. And you gave it all up and you went out on the road as quite a young man, dragging your poor wife with you, sleeping out of a VW camper for 9 months to start with, and then going on to do all these other books, about 20, 25 now, I think. And the question was why? And I don't think I'd ever either not wanted to focus on that or nobody had asked me. I mean, they said, what? You know, what have you done, or where have you been, and all that kind of stuff. But nobody says, well, why are you daft enough to do it? What's the driving force? And they made me think. And I went back through all my books and a lot of other things that were never published, and pulled together a book for them, which I still think is still, even though it's a paperback and it's quite modest, is still one of my favorite books, one of the books that I'm really proudest of. And the theme running through it, and that brings us back to the cook thing, is that I'd realized that all the traveling I was doing was really nothing much to do with wanting to see the world, although that was a wonderful, you know, a wonderful way of spending a life. But it was the inner journey, it was the soul's exploration that fascinated me, because they found that every time I was on the road, depending on where I was and what I was doing, I would find another facet, another side of myself that I'd never even met before. All kinds of bizarre selves. But, you know, I began to collect these selves, and they all became quite distinct personalities. And I'm told by my doctor that there's nothing wrong with me, you know, that apparently this is a very interesting philosophy. You know, it doesn't mean I'm multi-schizophrenic. And I think, you know, for that reason, I celebrate cooking in the same way as I celebrate creating a book, or I celebrate writing a good folk song and playing the guitar, and a dozen or so, in fact, two dozen or so other selves that keep popping up. And when I go back on the road, there'll be another dozen. And I think, to me, there's that wonderful phrase of Thoreau, you know, everybody overquotes Thoreau, but it's, you know, it's, we live but a fraction of our lives. Why don't we let in the flood and set all our wheels in motion? And, you know, it's similar to Walt Whitman when he says, we contain multitudes. It means each one of us. We each contain multitudes. And we don't celebrate that enough. I think we actually put ourselves into rather tight straitjackets and little boxes and say, that's me, that's David, that's Fred, that's Steve, that's Larry. And I don't think we celebrate enough our own diversities. And I think if we did, the world would actually be, without getting too pedantic, the world would actually be a far better place, because, you know, the more you can see a self that you have that's in somebody else, the easier it is to begin to understand them and empathize with them. And that's a hell of a good, you know, a hell of a good starting point for world peace.
That should almost be your manifesto. I mean, you know, The Way of the Wanderer is a wonderful, wonderful little book. And I think for me, what was the greatest pleasure in working on it with you was seeing all those selves and thinking about myself. Okay, am I just Larry the editor, or am I just Larry the writer, or am I Larry the father, and Larry the traveler? You know, you begin to tap into that a little bit.
Absolutely.
When you become conscious of it.
Absolutely. And also another thing happens, a reverse projection happens. For example, Harris. Harris has now become, it's a physical entity in terms of these magnificent mountains and the fact that these are really the oldest rocks on Earth. They're 3.5 billion years old. There's no other place on Earth that has rocks as old as Harris. And there's no other place, as far as I'm concerned, that has so many different varieties of mood and scenery in such a tiny place. They're like 14 miles by 6 miles. I mean, that's the size of it. But it's what happened to us when we were there is that we began to see Harris as a character. I mean, this island and the thread of the people living there, it became such, it was a whole David and Goliath story. You know, will Tweed survive? Because Tweed was having a very rough time. And their whole heritage is tied up with Tweed. I mean, there's fishing and other things, but Tweed is still what gives Harris its identity. And it started to become this story about the little island that could. You know, I mean, everything was against Harris. Even Japan had, because they made Tweed in Japan in a mill, they actually went to the, had the audacity to rename an island off the coast of Japan Harris, so that they could officially sell Harris Tweed.
Oh, that's too much.
Well, the world community pounced on them, but they managed to get away with it for about a year before they were caught. But I think we began to identify with this incredible determination that, damn it, you know, we are not going to give in. and we're going to find a way to make this work because it is so integral to who we are and what we've done for hundreds of years that we're just not going to lay down and die. And it was this wonderful sense, and we felt it too in Vasily Carter, this tremendous pride in what they already had, in the cohesion of the people and their beliefs and their religion and everything else into a harmonic whole. I think now something did happen. It's totally unexpectedly, just before we were leaving, when the mill, one of the mills, there were three mills, and they manufacture the warp to send out to the crafters, was going to close down and be sold. Sold primarily just as a building, not even as a going concern, because the production was that bad. And there was a wonderful fellow, Donald John Mackay, who worked down in the southern part of Harris and had a very good knack for blending certain patterns of tweed, very unusual bird's eye patterns of tweed. And he would occasionally, his wife would send these off to various manufacturers. Somehow, one of his swaths, one of his samples had gone through to Nike. And some person at Nike came up with the genius idea of reproducing a sneaker that they'd done very, very early at the beginning of their amazing success story in the 70s, I think, called the Terminator. And it looked nothing like the modern-day sneakers. It looked a very modest tennis shoe. But rather than wrapping it all in leather and all these fancy bits and pieces, they would wrap it almost entirely in Harris tweed. And that's what they did. And they, you know, they came in with this amazing order for 20,000 meters of tweed, which set the whole industry rolling again, even to the point where young kids were coming in as apprentices, which they hadn't known for about a couple of decades. So when I left, everybody was beginning to feel really, really proud that they'd managed to get through it. They've got hard times ahead, but, Harris to us is now almost a human being. It's almost a living presence, and we're incredibly proud to have written about that story.
That's an amazing story, actually, and I'm sure not very many people knew about it outside the UK and the industry.
Well, in fact, it's funny, Larry. I rediscovered an old schoolboy chum. Actually, it was one of these web things, find a friend or something like this. And he discovered me, and it turns out that this guy, who was used to be a real wastrel at school, I mean, he just was going absolutely nowhere. His father used to go crackers and, you know, told him that he was just going to end up as a drunk on the street and all this stuff. Turns out that this man is now the agent for J.K. Rowling of the Harry Potter series in England, and you can.
So he did pretty well for himself.
You can imagine. percent. But he's done. Believe me, in fact, we talked last week. Is the process of buying a bloody castle down in Spain. Anyway,
oh my goodness!
I he's got a copy of the book. The book just came out about 10 days ago, and I sent him a copy just to because he's a friend. And immediately he was back on the phone. He said, "Do you know what you've got in this story here? This Nike story. You've got a film. You know, do a screenplay." So we talk. I mean, he knows about it because he's been involved with all the Harry Potter screenplays. Even though he swears blind, he can't write a word. You know, he's not a writer, but he's certainly got a lot of gumption, a lot of common sense. So he and I sort of discussed it, and just between you and I and anybody else who's overhearing this, we're working on a possible screenplay called Tweed.
Nike saves Harris. I can see it now.
The working title is Tweed. It might even be a musical. We haven't decided yet.
Oh, geez. Oh, you're going to have a great time with that. David, you mentioned Harris feeling like a character to you, and that leads me to ask you about one thing I think your books are extraordinary for are all of the characters that parade through the pages of your books. And I think that's true in probably all of your books,
yeah,
where you have amazing people you just come across. And you're so adept at at capturing these people and bringing them to life. And I just wanted to ask you, you know, how does that happen? Is it by chance? Are you just such a warm, friendly guy that you meet these people everywhere, or do you really go seeking them out? How does that happen?
Yeah, I'm a warm, friendly, cuddly, Santa Claus-looking kind of guy, overweight, big white beard. I get on. I think it started when I grew this beard, and for some reason the beard went white very quickly. I never understood because my hair is still Irish. You know, I'm partly Irish, and it's an Irish auburn color. You know, at least it was. And I would, no matter where I went in the world, if I walked into some of these remote villages, and they were invariably remote because I wasn't really interested in villages that had been discovered, the first thing that would happen would be, rather than people rushing into the huts or whatever, and which very often happened to other travelers, the kids would come out and come rushing towards me. And they would always know the word Santa. I mean, it didn't matter where I went in the world, every kid seemed to know the word Santa. Not Father Christmas, not St. Nicholas, it was Santa, Santa Claus, Santa, Santa. And, of course, as soon as the kids started this wonderful jumping up and down and the laughter, the ice was broken, the mothers would come out, and then, you know, hesitantly, the husbands would come out. And before we knew it, you know, the whole village was doing this Santa thing, you know. So at that point, I decided not to shave off my beard, as it seemed to be a good way of getting an entree. But I think there's another reason too that I think a lot of travel writers, and I won't mention names, but they tend to be a little bit too self-focused for my taste, and rather maudlin with it, and. You know, some of them, I even question if they really enjoy travel that much, in which case I'm wondering what the hell are they doing, you know, wasting our time and their time. You know, get a proper job and stop pretending that you're a travel writer. If you don't enjoy the experience of travel, why bother? And I think very often with writers of that kind, you tend to get, it's a me, me, me thing, and you don't always get other characters drawn in three dimensions. To me, the whole point of traveling is to, well, as I said, it's really discovering yourself, but you're discovering yourself through other people. You're seeing parts of yourself reflected in other people, and hopefully vice versa. And and plus the fact I'm vulnerable. I mean, when I, you know, I don't have hotels lined up, and I'm invariably sleeping in the car or the tent or wherever I happen to be. I mean, the itineraries are very, very fragmented. And I found that being vulnerable and admitting to people that you're a little lost, that you're not quite sure where you're going to eat tonight or stay, and quite frankly, you could do with their help, you open up a Pandora's box, a beautiful Pandora's box of kindness, of warmth, of generosity. I mean, you can't really hurt a person who says, listen, especially a person who looks like Santa, and says I'm lost, you know, I really am lost, I don't know where the hell I am, and you're going to have to help me out here, you know. And I can say almost without exception, except for two cases in Morocco, without exception, it always opens up doors, and the people, you know, the people start to reveal themselves because they're not threatened by you. And
you mentioned three dimensions, drawing people in three dimensions, and you're an artist as well, and you have beautiful sketches in all of your books. And does that kind of help work with being an artist and seeing things and drawing? Does that help with the language? Does it help with you writing and capturing these characters?
Well,
do you think
certainly
it helps a better eye?
It does, but it also helps build bonds, friendships, because, you know, I do take a small camera with me, but I'm very, very careful how I use it, because, you know, some societies, some villages, especially more remote, get a little nervous. What I used to do is take a Polaroid, a small Polaroid, and take photographs very often of the children and then hand them out to the parents. And, of course, you know, they love that. The only problem was if you came to a village with 100 kids, you know, you went through your stack of Polaroids pretty damn fast.
Right.
So what I did was, usually it would depend on the situation, but if somebody had put me up for a night or two, which happened a lot, I would invariably end up sketching somebody in the family and leave them a sketch, as well as doing a sketch for the book, and that was because they could actually see me doing it. I think that was a little bit more magic than even a camera, even a photograph, you know, because it was a personal thing.
Well, another thing you do in your books, and we're running out of time, so we should probably just do a couple more questions here, but another thing you do in your books, and this speaks to your technique, and I think anybody who's interested in writing would be interested in hearing about this. A lot of your books have long and sometimes convoluted dialogue, really, really well-drawn, well-crafted dialogue with stage directions and you know, beautifully done descriptions of the action and such. And I'm just wondering how you do that. How do you accomplish that?
Wait till you see. How I do it, I don't know. I don't know how I do a lot of things. I don't even know how I cook, because I don't use recipes. I do have a kitchen full of you know, flavorings and all kinds of fusion things. But if you pin me down too much, I actually don't like to look too closely at what the magic is. Everybody seems to love it. We just had a couple of dinner parties this week where I didn't know what the hell I was going to do at 5 o'clock in the evening, and by 7:30, you know, there was a three-course dinner. And I don't like to look too closely at magic.
Well, in terms of the dialogue, do you live through a scene and then immediately
I always carry a tape recorder. I always carry.
Okay.
It's a little tiny, tiny thing. It literally is half the size of a cigarette packet, and it's a beauty. It's been with me for years. I don't know how the heck it's lasted so long. Sometimes, you know, if I'm being really professional, I will ask permission and say, I have a tape recorder. But I've seen that spoil conversation so many times that if I feel this is too, I'm not going to be able to remember the rhythm and the words, I'll use the tape, and I just transcribe the tape and then edit it down to whatever I want. You know, some of the dialogue I've got on tape from Ireland, particularly, I mean, they humor and the rhythm, the eloquence. These fishermen, I mean, many of them, you know, finished school about the age of 14, 15. They didn't have huge educations, but my God, the eloquence of these guys when they talk.
Yeah.
Is just staggering. I mean, there's going to be a lot more dialogue in this book than any other book I've done, just because I'm giving them center stage. I'm taking a back seat. Their characters are so strong and so rich in imagery that you know, that I'm just going to write down what they tell me. You know.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I will look forward to that. I'm sure it'll be a wonderful book. I want to close with one question that I like to ask everybody when I do these interviews. If you had three books to recommend to readers, you know, you could only pick three out of all the books you've read over your life, what would they be?
Well, I think I would take Walden, Walden Pond. It's been hyped to death, but I think there are very few people that actually read it cover to cover. I'd be tempted to take Leaves of Grass, but I find some of that a little bit too dense. I think I'd take at least two of the notebooks of Leonardo da Vinci. I have four, and I think I'd like to take all four, but consider it to be one volume.
Right.
Let me see, the third one. I think one of the early travel writers, Thesinger, would be one that would come, or Van der Post, I think. Some of the early books by Van der Post, or Andrew Harvey, they contain a spiritual element in them, which many of the books nowadays it kind of ignore. Andrew Harvey particularly can be awfully eloquent. I think that would do it, so long as you can throw in a Shakespeare as well here and there, you know.
Of course. And asking for three books is really a diabolical question, because there are so many countless great books in the world. Well, I guess we're going to sign off here, and you know, and I want to thank you, David, for taking the time to talk with us.
You know, I think you should invite Larry and I over for dinner.
We'll meet you in Ireland.
And then read to us.
What a charming idea. Get yourselves over here. I'll get something ready by 7 o'clock.
Well, I think we should wait until you're on the Barra Peninsula again, and we'll come to the southwest corner of Ireland.
Larry.
Have a few pints and a real meal.
Wherever you turn up, you'll be more than welcome.
Thanks very much, David.
My pleasure. God bless. Bye-bye.
If you'd like to leave us email regarding tonight's podcast, drop us a line at ontheair@applausecast.com. If you'd like to have ApplauseCast produce a podcast for you or your organization, email us at sales@applausecast.com or call us at 650-400-3929. This has been an ApplauseCast production. Thanks for listening.